You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
Today's podcast is with Dr. Sunita Saw, who is an award-winning professor at Cornell University and an expert in organizational psychology. She's also a trained physician who practiced medicine in the UK. She's got a fantastic new book. It's called Defy: The Power of No in a World That Demands Yes. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch.
Dr. Sunita Saw, welcome to the podcast.
Very happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So, having been steeped in the culture of yes and for nearly four decades, it's actually not unusual for someone to assume that we are somehow anti-no. Well, that's actually not true. So I was eager to interview you based on the title of your book, and even more eager to talk having read the book. And at the end, towards the end of your book, you write, quote, "For far too long, compliance has been our default. We have said yes so often and for so long that we have forgotten what it means. And we have reserved no for the iconoclasts, the revolutionaries, and the troublemakers," end quote. Can you talk more about how saying no can increase your agency as a human being?
Right. So absolutely. I mean, my experience and many others that I've spoken to and in my research, what I have found is that compliance, saying yes, is our default. Mm-hmm. So certainly for me as a child, I was known for being an obedient daughter and a student. And I even asked my dad at one point when I was quite young, what does my name mean? And he told me Sunita in Sanskrit means good. And I mostly lived up to that. You know, I did what I was told, went to school like I was told to. I got up when I was told to. I even had my hair cut the way my parents wanted me to have it cut, which I detested. But these were the messages that I received and what many others also receive as a child. You know, be good, which means to obey. Don't question authority. Listen to your teachers. They know best. Just fit in. Be polite. And so we often get these messages, especially girls, I think. And it's also a dynamic, I think, that's very familiar to many children of first immigrants, that we have this strict upbringing and these expectations for high achievements. And certainly that level of compliance becomes ingrained. We become socialized. And so we become wired to comply. So in that way, we are losing some aspect of our agency. And to reclaim it, we need to understand that we have choices in our behavior. And being defiant doesn't necessarily mean that we are being bad. In fact, it's sometimes good to be bad. It's sometimes, you know, we sacrifice a lot by being so compliant.
You actually open the book with two stories. So one is well known. It's the knee on the neck of George Floyd. The other is personal. Can you tell us what happened to you?
Yes, I can. So I moved from the UK to the US, and I was experiencing some chest pain. And I had never felt anything like it before. And so I was a little concerned about this. And I went to the emergency room. And I also trained as a physician. So, of course, you're going to the emergency room because you think there's something perhaps terrible going on. And in the emergency room, they kind of rushed around and they did an electrocardiogram, other tests. and my heart was fine. So that was my main concern. So everything looked good. And I thought I was going to be discharged and sent home. But all of a sudden they said, no, you need to have a CT scan just to make sure you don't have a pulmonary embolism. Mm-hmm. And that means a blood clot in the lung. And I had done respiratory medicine. So I knew that this a pulmonary embolism would cause what we call pleuritic chest pain, which is a sharp pain. Like you feel it when you breathe in and breathe out. And I knew I didn't have that. And so I didn't really want the CT scan, but I was being kind of pushed around in the hospital and then into the scanner. And I wanted to say no, but I found it very difficult to do so. And so I asked like a couple of questions, like, oh, it's not a high amount of radiation. I thought they would pick up on my discomfort and ask me whether I really wanted it. And then I realized nobody was going to do that. Oh. And I ended up just complying with this CT scan that I just knew was not necessarily, I knew it would be clear, which it was, and just basically had to endure extra radiation that I didn't need at that point.
I think, you know, I mean, you know, you have this background and still, and I think we've all, I mean, I've experienced this. I was literally just getting my shoulder looked at and they did a scan and it was fine. And then he was like, well, let's sign you up for physical therapy. And I'm like, I actually work with a trainer every Saturday. So I don't think I need an extra. He's like, well, and I'm like, no, she's actually affiliated with a hospital. Like, and I had to like, it was work for me. And I knew what was happening here.
Yes.
So, and I think what's interesting, you know, certainly one of the things that people take out of learning improvisation is getting comfortable with discomfort. Mm-hmm. You have to, because you don't have a script. You're screwing up all the time at the beginning, and you just have to be comfortable with like, okay, well that's going to happen. And you even say in the book, quote, discomfort is the key to our power to defy. So how do you see that in the context you're discussing it?
So I felt that tension. I definitely felt that tension. And sometimes we just go along with complying because we think that our doubts or our tension are just not worth the effort. And so we just try to ignore it. We push it down. We swallow our feelings. And, you know, even though we're shaking our head, we're going along with it. When in actual fact, we could use that tension. I talk about tension actually being the strength. Like it could be a signal. It's a signal that something's wrong, perhaps. It's now the time to defy. And that tension often comes from what I call resistance to resistance. So you actually, we want to, as soon as we know that we want to defy, it feels so uncomfortable because we're so trained to comply with other people. And so we feel this tension between doing what we think is right and acting in alignment with our values and feeling the pressure from someone else to just comply with them for a large range of reasons we might feel that pressure. But if we could use that tension and acknowledge it rather than trying to wish it away, then what I've actually found is when you work through, and I talk about the five stages of defiance in the book, when you get to that final act of actually defying, much of that tension dissipates. It goes away, which is really nice. Whereas when I was having that CT scan, I thought, okay, I'll go along with it, even though I feel uncomfortable. The tension didn't go away. I started to feel more and more uncomfortable, and I regretted having that so much that it made me think, why couldn't I say the words that I wanted to say? The one thing I wanted to do was refuse, and I couldn't do it. So what can I do better next time?
You start off chapter two with this thought experiment that you often start your graduate school business classes with. Can you run us through that? I thought it was a great example of this.
Sure, absolutely. In this thought experiment, I asked my students, and I changed it a little bit in the book, you know, to think about a situation where, so in the book, we had two cars that were racing to meet the, to break the land speed record. And you're an engineer in a team, and you feel that your car is the best, you know, is the fastest, is the most efficient, and you really want to win because it's being televised and there's all this excitement around winning the race and the substantial sort of financial reward. And for you and your team, it would be amazing. But there is a slight problem in that there's some technical issue with the car, and that technical issue has been present, but you're not really sure when it occurs and when it doesn't occur. Is it due to the weather? Is it due to humidity? You're not quite sure, and the data isn't conclusive, but you just feel that something could go wrong, like the tires could you know, explode. So you're not sure what to do, and you look at all the data, you don't have anything conclusive, and you present your findings to your boss, and they're like, well, we don't know for sure. And your boss obviously wants to go ahead because this mm-hmm. is a great opportunity. If you don't race, the other team is going to win and get all the rewards, and you have to be in it to win it. So it goes to a vote, and everybody in the team has to vote, and you see that everybody is voting yes, 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 and you're the only one that's kind of thinking, I'm not sure. So how do you make that decision? And I do ask my students to do a very similar exercise in my class. And I first actually ask them to make an individual decision and then mm-hmm. go into their group so they know what they actually want. And then we can see how many of the people who originally dissented changed their minds. And pretty much every year after year, I've taught this course for like over 10 years now, I have like, when it comes to the group decision and there's one group spokesperson, it's yes, 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 yes. Yeah. Occasionally we get one no, but it's overwhelmingly yes. And then when we found out really that we look at all the data and it turns out they shouldn't have gone ahead with the race, they're kind of stunned. It's a big learning experience for them. And we talk about why the dissenters couldn't speak up in such a situation.
And this is based on a real life tragic example.
That's right. It's based on the Challenger disaster and how a group of engineers felt very strongly that they should not launch because the weather was too cold, and they were worried about the effect on the O-rings. And even at that particular point in time, they'd not looked at the data in such a way that would prove this, but later analysis of that data shows that it was over 94% probability that the O-rings was going to explode. They had to explain to their team and to the management team why they shouldn't go ahead. And when the management team were basically told, you know, put on your management hat, not your engineer's hat, and they made the decision to go ahead with this, it was really devastating for them.
And there are many other examples of this in aviation and in nuclear facilities and all that. And what I thought was so interesting about this is, when I've read about this in other contexts, it's often about like people hiding stuff, mistakes. But the way you're framing it too is almost like, no, it's almost like a natural reflex as a human to go with the crowd, to not be that one who's standing out, even if you were a no before you walked in that room. And those are powerful social forces. And isn't there a tax to be paid sometimes for saying no?
Absolutely. Yeah, there are consequences for defying, for sure, right? We could lose a job, we could lose a relationship. And these are the reasons that people often don't say no, because they're aware that they're fearful of those consequences. But it can lead to, as we've said, serious problems, not just with the Challenger, but the others that you admitted. And even in healthcare, in my background, there was a survey that found that 9 out of 10 healthcare workers, most of them nurses, don't feel comfortable speaking up when they see their mm-hmm. colleagues making a mistake. And another survey found that in over 1,700 crew members in commercial airlines, they also don't feel comfortable when they see their superiors making an error. So these could be life and death consequences where we really need to look at why people find it so difficult to say no. So yes, they are consequences, but there's also consequences of being compliant. Like if you, I'm sure a lot of people regret not speaking up. With the Challenger engineers at Morton Thiokol, so the engineers that had the contract with NASA, the people who dissented never regretted not speaking up. They just wished they could have done more. It's almost like if you don't, research that I've done with a colleague, Caitlin Woolley, also at Cornell University, shows that if we know better and we don't, and we just go along with something, even that if we know it's bad advice, if we go against our better judgment, we often feel worse. And we often blame ourselves more than the other person who told us to go along with it. And we call this the kicking yourself syndrome. So there's definitely costs of being compliant. And if you disregard your values, you know, emotionally and physically, it has an effect. If we're constantly bowing our head to other people and not living our life the way that we think we should.
Caitlin's at Cornell now?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes, she was in Chicago.
Right. Yeah, Chicago's where when I worked with her. And I think Vanessa Bonds is at Cornell, right?
That's right. Yeah, she's at the Iowa Law School. Yeah.
Did you see, she was part of that study, which probably came out after you wrote the book, where they would have people, half a group came into the room. They'd ask them to unlock their phones because they were going to take the phones outside. I use this example when I talk a lot about no, because the people would just say yes. Like they would let them unlock their phones and leave. But what I thought was fascinating about the group that mostly didn't were handed a script. So literally you say, Kelly, I don't want you to take my phone out. And it made me think, and this is not completely thought through, but, you know, in improvisation, when we talk about yes and, this is when you and I are given, we have no script, we're told to make something out of nothing, we're using our full creative selves. And this idea that when you also need to work with people and you need to them have a sense of psychological safety and you have to make sure that the no is okay, you have to hand them a script. That's the place for a script. And I just find that kind of an interesting dichotomy.
Yes, it is. And so Vanessa has some fantastic work on how much we're also what I call wired to comply. So, yeah. So the original study where she had that people come in and the request that we want to look at your phone and they unlock their phone, so many people complied with that, which is amazing to see. The script idea is also really interesting and whether it could work or not, like handing someone a script to say, you know, which is nice because there's one element, if it works, it's nice because it doesn't depend on the individual to have the burden of trying to prepare beforehand. And what I recall from that study is that it did change the feelings. Like people felt like they were more likely, they had more freedom to say no. But not so much their behavior. So the levels of compliance between the two groups were quite similar. So if you're looking at whether people actually said no, the script alone wasn't as powerful there, but the feelings did change. So it could be some aspect of cognitive dissonance.
Right.
And so I think it's empowering the individuals in some way. And what I recommend is make your own scripts, but you need to practice it beforehand. Because if you practice and role play and practice, it actually changes some of that wiring and makes it more of our default than the wiring to comply. So we can act again in that situation. And I certainly found that after I had the CT scan, for example, that I went over it in my head. Why did I do that? You know, I have the training, I have the medical knowledge, I know I can say no without much consequence. So why did I just go along with it? And I practiced and I anticipated that this is likely to happen again. And when it did happen again, about a year later, I was able to say no the second time around. And that also took a lot of work. Like you were saying, it took a lot of work because I had shoulder pain as well, and they wanted me to have an X-ray. So less radiation than a CT scan, but still, you know, now I had learned that this happens a lot. And so I remember being in that particular hospital and they were sending me from one place to the next place. And I saw the sign that said X-ray department. And in my head, I kind of laughed to myself, oh, wouldn't it be funny if they wanted me to go for an X-ray before I see the doctor? That thought sort of fleetingly went across my mind. And then that's exactly what they tried to do. And then, yeah, they didn't know what to do with me in the end. It was like, I had to see one medical professional, another one. And each time they'd open the file, I was like, no, no X-ray. It's like, no. It's like almost comedy in the end. The next one, no X-ray.
That's right.
No.
Yeah, I mean, literally, as I'm doing this right now on the Zoom, like, I just do this exercise every morning and it already feels better. So it's like, all
the
right.
Physical therapy.
it's funny, right? We talk about this in the podcast all the time, which is like, we absolutely understand why we rehearse before big moments, whether it's, what's more important than your life?
Exactly.
And I when I read that study, I started using that technique, especially when I was working in a situation where I was the dominant figure. I had the most status because I honestly don't want to ever have someone feel they have to do something with me because, you know, I have a bigger title or I've been here longer. And, you know, sort of like you pointed out, most people actually did say yes, but I could tell that the relationship was warmer.
Yes. Yeah. You so know? Feelings definitely change.
Yeah.
If we are looking at sort of changing the environments, there is a very nice study conducted by a couple of Georgetown professors that they conducted on minibuses. And this is because in Kenya, there's a lot of bus crashes, right? Accidents where many people, hundreds of thousands, lose their lives. And the majority of those crashes, the cause is to do with speeding, the driver's speeding. And so these researchers, they had like a really simple thing that they tried out, which was to put these stickers in the buses in prominent places where the passengers could read them, which basically said, Zusha, which means speak up or protest. You have the power to slow down a reckless driver. And they put that in some buses and they didn't put it in another group of buses. And the results were really dramatic. It decreased the number of accidents hugely and saved so many lives that just this simple sticker had an effect on the environment. So we don't know exactly why. We just know like the final outcome. But it could be that the passengers did feel more empowered. They were more likely to speak up because the norms had changed because there were these stickers. Or it could be that the drivers anticipated that the norms have changed and people are going to speak up and tell them. So they drove slower. But either way, this had really a powerful effect on changing the environment. So you might want to think about putting stickers up, you know, around. You can say no, you know, it's okay to defy.
Yes,
and that
absolutely
could also have an effect.
Can you talk about the difference between compliance and consent? How are those different?
Sure. So I take the definition of informed consent from medicine that I learned, which has five elements, and apply it to consent in other sort of critical decisions that we make in our lives to determine what is consent rather than compliance. Because compliance is just going along with something and it's largely imposed by someone else's wishes or the environments. Whereas what I call a true yes, informed consent, requires five elements. And they are capacity, that you have the capacity to make this decision. You're not impaired in any way. You're not under the influence of drugs or anything else. So you have the capacity, first of all. You have the knowledge. You've been given the knowledge. And third, you understand that knowledge. Just being given all the information doesn't mean that you truly understand it. And that you have the freedom to say no. There is actually some choice that you can say no. And if those four elements are all yes, then you have to give your authorization that, you know, so that's your thoroughly considered authorization of consent that you go along with this. If not, then you give your informed refusal.
And I guess, you know, when you think about that, that's a lot of steps that we're probably doing in a split second, which then gives thought that, you know, maybe the most powerful thing you could do is pause.
Yes, the power of the pause. And I talk about that in my book a lot. It's so helpful because one of the things you might want to, you know, somebody said, how can we determine like whether to defy or not to defy when we're in a particular situation? And it's like, well, the first question might be, does this situation violate my values? And you might want to take a step back and think about, like, first of all, does it violate your values or not? And second, do you have these elements in which you can give a true yes or a true no, your informed consent, or whether you need to defy? So taking some time out would be great. And I also anticipating. You know, a lot of times we can anticipate when we need to defy, that situations almost become predictable. Like, I know at work, like at some point, you know, I'm going to experience either a sexist remark or a racist remark, or I'm going to hear something inappropriate. And we can anticipate those. And so we can start visualizing it and then scripting ourselves, making those scripts and rehearsing those scripts so we feel in the moment that we can take action. And that's what this book is about, is coming up with an action plan long before that moment of crisis. So when we're in that situation, we know how to act.
I had the, it was a real gift a few weeks ago to spend about a week at Quantico for FBI training. Like hostage negotiation training. Oh. And we observed, actually, we led some workshops as well. It was amazing. But one of the classes was a very specific case study. It was an incident that happened in Phoenix, and someone had barricaded themselves in, and, you know, all this terrible stuff happened. And it escalated and escalated and escalated. And the lesson that came at the very end, and this is a retired, brilliant retired FBI agent, was that all these deaths could have been avoided if they had just done nothing.
Oh, wow. Yes. Yes.
Right. And I was just like, oh, my God. So, because his audience, right, these are all senior law enforcement. They are people who, and you, these guys and women are, you know, so strong, they could go through a wall. So, of course, their instinct is going to be to act. That is why they're there. And he's sort of saying you have to get in a space where you understand the right thing maybe is to not act. And that you can completely see why that would be unnatural for these folks.
Right. And I also talk about in the book something called conscious compliance.
Yeah.
Which is when we do have all the elements for consent and for defiance. So we know that we have the capacity, the knowledge and understanding. Perhaps there is some freedom to say no, but the costs are too great. You know, it's probably not safe, or it's not going to have the impact that we want. And in those situations, we might want to comply, but we know that we're doing it. It's not just like we're falling into it without thinking about it. We're actually making a conscious decision that at this point, I'm going to comply. And that might not last forever, but at this particular point in time, that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah, well, it's often not safe. You know, it isn't. For so many factors.
You have to assess the risk. Yeah.
Insinuation anxiety. I had never heard the term. I can't stop thinking about it.
Yes.
Explain what it is.
Yeah.
And how, oh my God, it's just, because I, you know, immediately I'm thinking of stories in which I've done exactly this.
Yes. So I didn't know the term for it, but it is a feeling I've had all my life. And so, insinuation anxiety is that we don't want to insinuate that the other person is anything other than that, what they appear to be. You don't want to send them a negative evaluation. So it could happen in numerous situations where, for example, your boss asks you to do something or comes up with an idea that they think is great and you don't. Or somebody in the room, a group of people are acting in a very biased way towards a particular individual who's not there. And you want to say something, but you can't. And even in sort of small stake environments, like you could have your hair cut. And instead of telling them that you don't like it, you're just like, oh, it's great. Thank you. Bye. Because we don't want to admit that somebody else is incompetent or that they could be biased or even corrupt. And I found this some psychological process come up so many times in my experiments that you don't trust this particular advice, but you go along and you comply with it because you don't want to signal that distrust to the other person. You don't want them to know. You know, it's just too uncomfortable. And so you end up going along with it. You just don't want to insinuate that they could be wrong. You know?
I don't like to prescribe comedy to non-comedy professionals, but this is a case in which comedy is actually an excellent weapon, right? Because you can see it is a way of like, I don't know about this, you know, and then let the tension laugh and everyone, and then it evens the room a little bit, maybe to have a discussion or maybe make another choice. That's not easy for everyone to do. And there's a tax if you don't have the status to be able to make that joke. You know, it depends on your situation.
Yeah. And I think that would be a great way to have some comedy or laughter come in to sort of dissipate that, so everybody knows what's going on. But not everybody has a skill set to do that,
No,
right? And
no.
sometimes it's quite difficult in when I was talking about the healthcare workers, 9 out of 10 not feeling comfortable to speak up. A lot of that could be due to insinuation anxiety, that they don't want to insinuate that their colleague is wrong and they're doing something wrong, and they're going to be called out for it. And the same with the crew members not wanting to call out their superiors, right? It's so difficult to do, and it's a strong feeling.
Years ago, when Second City had a theater in Detroit, we were there maybe around 10 years or so. I was staying in this apartment complex, and there was a diner there, and there was this African American, well, older African American woman, and I held the door for her like at least 3 times, and we actually ended up having coffee together, and it was Rosa Parks, which I didn't know until, yes, it is
Incredible.
one of my favorite stories of all time. It was just,
I did not see that coming.
no, because at some point I go, "I'm Kelly," and she goes, "I'm Rosa," and I'm like, "Wait," and she and I've read the story in some other literature, but it's this mythology we all grew up with about Rosa Parks just taking this in. You know, she was tired, and you know, she just finally made, and none of that was true. You can talk a bit about this. I'd love the audience to hear why this
Yeah,
is important to know.
absolutely. I mean, this is something I believe that has been misunderstood over a long period of time. And even, you know, the LA Times said that she was tired all over when she made her decision to not move on the bus. And I think it was the New York Times that also called her the accidental matriarch of the civil rights movement. And that just diminishes all the preparation that Rosa Parks went through to get to that particular day. She had a lifetime of training to get there. She also had what I find very interesting, two examples that must have stayed with her. Once, when she was a child, her mother refused to move on the bus, and she saw that particular scenario play out, that the driver threatened to throw her mother off the bus if she didn't get up and move. And her mother just said, "I don't think you will do that." And that became the end of it. And that must have stayed with her. And I do think it's really powerful when we see our parents defying in a situation that is quite strong, or something unusual. I talk about my own mum's defiance in the book as well. I've heard lots of stories about people observing their parents defying that really have an effect on them years later, maybe not like straight away, but when they think about that incident. And then later, I think just 9 months before she took her sort of principled stance of not moving, there was a teenager that she was mentoring, Claudine Covette, who also didn't move on the bus. And she saw this happen. And even though the teenager was arrested, she wanted to use it as a case study to really highlight why this was so important, and hopefully make a good point. They didn't in the end, because the girl was so young. But when it came to her, she was older. She had the support of a network and strategists around her, so she knew it could make a difference. And that day she decided to do it. And what's so interesting to me is everything that led up to that day. I feel like Rosa Parks was practicing for that day all her life. It wasn't just a spontaneous decision. She did do something extraordinary, but she was preparing for that day for a very long time.
And that narrative, the spin on the narrative, feels it could. There's many bad places that emanates from, racism, misogyny, also a certain kind of, like, it has to be magic because otherwise it's a failing of our moral and ethic. And this is the point of the book, which is this you can defy when you're aligned with your values, but you have, and you say this, like, you got to know what your values are. And I don't know if you if I took a poll at Second City right now and asked people if they could tell me their values, I would imagine that's a small percentage that would be able to do it.
Yes. So, and I have all my students do this as an exercise because we don't often think about what our values are unless we're explicitly asked to. And yet I've learned that so many of us, the distance between who we think we are and what we actually do is really so big. It's enormous. And you know, my research has shown me again and again, what somebody believes their values to be is quite different from how they actually behave. And so articulating those values is a really helpful thing to do. Like, it's just, if you don't know your values, then how are you going to know when to defy or not? Right? So articulating those values and thinking about who am I? Does this situation violate those values? And then what does a person like me do in this situation can get us closer to aligning our life to be within what we intend it to be, you know, to be in alignment with our values, and our attentions and behavior come closer together.
In my experience, my values have changed over time. Absolutely. Because of own personal experience, knowledge, you know, all these things. And again, we are just not we think the mythology, the cultural code is that no, you're born with a value, and that's what that you stick with that the whole time. And that's just decidedly not how it works. So I wonder too, is it because you're a teacher? Don't you? I mean, like, this feels so much more important to be teaching our young children than some of the things we teach our young children.
I think we get so much training. I mean, it's not just values, right? We get much training in being compliant. We don't get the training in being defiant.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So if we can have children articulate their aspirational self, like what their values are, who they wish to be, mm-hmm. and then what then do they do in that situation? I think that would be an amazing skill to have. If we could teach this in every job, like as an aspect of like training, that not just being aware of these things intellectually, but actually practicing and role-playing so those neurons change and we actually get the behavioral training in defiance would make such a difference to our world. So, yeah, that's wonderful. We can try. We can aim for that, right,
yeah.
Kelly?
Yeah, well, yeah, yeah. We'll try. We got to. We have to. Next generation. I mean, I have a lot of faith in the next generation. I mean, it's one of the gifts of, you know, teaching like you do, or me working in a place like Second City, is it is just one generation after the next generation the experience, and they're always. I think we tend to focus a lot on their differences as opposed to the things that vast majority, which is we care about the same things. But you know, there's a lot of the young people coming into our theater right now are passionate, and they're well read, and they're curious, and they are. They are less compliant, which, you know, for a lot of companies that they're having a hard time with this. And, you know, we get hired a lot to come in and help with the cross-generational communication. But I know for a fact, most of them are like, can't you just get them to be compliant? It's like, that's yes. Not going to do it.
I know. And this is one of the issues is that we think that compliant workers are the best, right? And to be a good employee, you have to be obedient. And if we take that on, if we internalize it, because we get so many rewards for being compliant, yep. If we start internalizing it, then we do have this ethical fading of like we're letting things slip that we wouldn't have thought was acceptable before. And it now becomes the norm that we do things that we actually, if we thought about it, would not be what we want to do.
We wouldn't do them. All right. We always end the podcast with a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
I certainly do. So, and it is interesting with the yes and, since there's different types of yeses, as I explained in my book, right? So there is the yes that is the true consent that has the five elements. And then there's the yes that is just compliance. And as you know, in my life, I've had lots of moments of just simply complying because I had a masterclass in compliance growing up. And one, the biggest yes, which is my compliant yes that I have had that impacted my life, was to do medicine. So as I grew up, I got the grades because I was also being so compliant. And so in my community, family, teachers, community, medicine is the best thing you can do. Why would you not want to do medicine and become a doctor? It's the best thing you can do. So I did. I said yes. And I went to medical school, which in the UK is a combined undergraduate and graduate degree. So you start at the age of 18 and you're a doctor by the time you're 23.
Oh, I didn't realize that. You're 23.
So I did do that. I did say yes. But and at the same time, I took a year out of my 5-year medical degree to do a degree in psychology. I took the third year out and I was put with the 4th year psychology students. And I did this intercalated degree in psychology. And I loved that year so much. Like the just the learning and the differences. And that's when I read about the Milgram electric shock experiments and how so many subjects were compliant and the defiant subjects were the ones that were actually good. And even though I did what was expected and went back and graduated from medical school and ended up working as a doctor, I never forgot those psychology days. And that's why I'm doing what I do now. So that was my big yes and that affected my life. And even to this day, I'm still doing a yes and to a certain extent because I'm a professor at the business school in Cornell. So, but I teach the healthcare leadership course. That was one of the reasons they hired me, which is a course between the business school and the medical school. But my primary appointment is at the business school, and I'm expected to publish in management journals. But I also, my and, yes, I will do that, but and I will also publish in medical journals and public policy journals and other journals. So I'm still going with the yes and every now and again, but I'm hoping my yes is closer to consent and not compliance now.
The book is called Defy, The Power of No in a World That Demands Yes. Dr. Sini Lasaw, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. Very much enjoyed this conversation.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Soul, screaming atop their lungs. survive.